Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and with us now, University of Tennessee law professor Glenn Reynolds, the man behind the libertarian Instapundit blog. He now has his second book out about radically transforming education as we know it. The first was called The Higher Education Bubble, in which he predicted a student loan market crash similar to the mortgage loan crash, and how he wants to break the college monopoly on professional credentials. The new one is The New School, How the Information Age Will Save American Education from Itself. We'll talk about his ideas on education and get his Instapundit take on parts of the State of the Union address. Glenn, thanks for doing this. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's always good to be back.
And listeners, if you're a Glenn Reynolds Instapundit reader or anyone else, 212-433-WNYC. So your new book is more about K through 12, but can we talk some higher education first? Do you still think that student loan market is unstable?
Oh, I think it is. And in fact, you know, one of the interesting things I've seen is over the last few months, it seems to be accelerating. A lot of colleges and universities have had their credit ratings downgraded. I just saw that Yeshiva University was downgraded to junk, actually, by credit rating agencies who basically just don't think people are going to be able or willing to borrow and spend as much to pay rising tuitions as they used to be. And, you know, we're seeing schools laying off professors. We're seeing some small schools going out of business or merging. I mean, you're seeing the early signs of a contraction brought about by the fact that it's just too expensive to go to college now. It just costs more than most people can afford and more than the earnings on the back end can support.
Then again, student loan debt is not protected by bankruptcy laws. That is, by declaring personal bankruptcy, you don't get out of your student loans. So wouldn't the banks consider it a very good risk as loans go and keep lending?
Well, I think they'll keep lending. I think the question is that the customers, the students and their parents, are thinking a lot harder about borrowing. And I think that's because what you see is a lot of people who have graduated from college and sometimes from graduate school or law school who owe a lot of money and can't get jobs. And that's sort of filtering out into the younger brothers and cousins and friends and such community. And people are just becoming much less willing to take on debt and these sort of blithe assumption that they're going to have no trouble paying it all back.
So let me play a clip of President Obama from the State of the Union address where he references higher education and see if you and he, who are opposed to each other on many policies, might actually have a little confluence on reforming the economics of college. Here's 40 seconds of the president from Tuesday night. He begins with his shout out to that student from New York.
Stephen Rodriguez couldn't speak a word of English when he moved to New York City at age 9. But last month, thanks to the support of great teachers and an innovative tutoring program, he led a march of his classmates through a crowd of cheering parents and neighbors from their high school to the post office where they mailed off their college applications. And this son of a factory worker just found out he's going to college this fall. 5 years ago, we set out to change the odds for all our kids. We worked with lenders to reform student loans, and today more young people are earning college degrees than ever before.
So, President Obama from the State of the Union, and Glenn Harlan Reynolds, what do you think about the reforms that the Obama administration has undertaken? I know he met with college presidents just recently and tried to talk about, you know, the rising cost of tuition and fees and doing something about it. So are you and the president thinking along the same lines or different lines about how to solve the problem?
I think we're on the same page to a substantial degree, although exactly what policy they're going to produce is still a little bit fuzzy. But he said in his State of the Union 2 years ago that they would consider reducing federal aid to schools whose tuition grew too fast. And I assume that is likely to happen at some point. My own reforms would be to make student loans dischargeable in bankruptcy after a period of years, which actually is how the law used to be, and then put universities and colleges on the hook for some fraction of that debt giving them some skin in the game and taking away the incentive to let students run up huge amounts of debt for things that are not likely to earn them a living later.
Interesting. And also exciting to many people might be your idea that a new organization is needed to break the college monopoly on certifying workers' credentials. That is, if something other than a college degree, which is so expensive and takes a minimum of 4 years, could prove to employers that you have the particular skills to work in entry-level jobs in their fields. Do you see anything specific coming down the pike?
There is some movement on that front. In sort of the industrial area, the Manufacturing Institute has got this program of stackable certificates, and they're working with community colleges and some other groups to generate those. At a higher level, you have both the ETS people and the ACT people, as well as, and I'm blanking on the name, it's CEA, but I forget what it stands for now. They have with a test called the CLA Plus, the Collegiate Learning Assessment, all of which are designed to tell employers that people have actually learned something useful in college and possess some identifiable skills. And it right now, most of this stuff is actually being done in coordination with colleges and universities. But it seems to me that a lot of people are going to say, if I can pass the certification, why should I have to spend 4 years and six figures going to college?
Right. And there's a liberal critique that says employers themselves used to do a lot more training of the workers. And now they're complaining to the media and the government all the time that there's a mismatch between skills and open jobs, that there's, you know, a lot of unemployment, but there are also a lot of job openings because people don't have the right skills. But by doing that, they're trying to shift the responsibility from themselves onto the public to pay for additional training programs. Do you see any merit in that point of view?
I think that's exactly right. I mean, it's a little bit like the NFL, which, you know, uses colleges as its farm team at no expense to itself. And I think there is something to that. I think that there are certainly plenty of exceptions, but most employers aren't willing to invest very much in training. And you can see it's like a perfect situation for them. It doesn't matter to them that it costs you $100,000 to get your degree before they'll hire you, because right. That cost all goes in your pocket. That said, at some level, it does hurt them. If I'm an employer and I have a choice between two otherwise identical candidates, and one of them has gone to college and owes, let's even pick something modest, like, say, $60,000, $80,000 in student loan debts, and the other has gotten a certificate and owes nothing, I'm going to figure probably that the second one is going to be willing to work for somewhat less and is going to be somewhat happier because they're not burdened by all that debt. And I'm going to see that, I think, as a plus.
Glenn Harlan Reynolds, his blog that you may know is Instapundit, his position is a law professor at the University of Tennessee, and his new book is The New School, How the Information Age Will Save American Education from Itself. And you recall the origins of our current model of K-12 education as having originated in 19th century Prussia. Why is that relevant to what's going on today?
Well, it's just sort of interesting that, actually both our higher ed and K-12 models were imported from Germany in the 19th century, and nothing wrong with 19th century Germany. Frankly, it did a lot better than 20th century Germany in a lot of ways, but it's kind of a dated
model. That's a low bar, but go ahead.
Well, yeah. What happened was Horace Mann, who was the secretary of the Massachusetts Board of Education, was looking for a model for taxpayer-funded, state-run education. And he traveled around Europe looking at a lot of different models.
What year are we talking about?
Let's see. This would have been – his report came out in 1837, so this would, I guess, have been 1836, the year before.
Yep.
And he traveled around, and the one he liked best was the, quite frankly, nationalist model used in Prussia, in which schools were seen as tools to indoctrinate the populace with the characteristics that the government thought were good. And when he came back to the United States, he got some pushback on that. A lot of people said that was an un-American model, that the American model says that the people know more than the government, and the Prussian model is premised on the idea that the government knows more than the people. But he won, and we got essentially that model as the model for our public schools. As I say in the book, it's not like this was so terrible. It taught people a lot of skills that, in fact, we needed in the Industrial Revolution, things like showing up on time and following instructions accurately and so on. Which it was designed to do. And the Industrial Revolution left everybody an awful lot better off at the end of the day. But you know, the Industrial Revolution was a long time ago, and we're sort of not in the Henry Ford, you can have your car in any color you want so long as it's black era anymore. And as somebody else said, I keep using this line, but I'm not sure who said it originally when I heard it, in an era when you have 900 kinds of shampoo, why would you only have one kind of school?
Yeah, and we're not in the industrial age anymore. We're in the information age, and the subtitle of your book is How the Information Age Will Save Education from Itself. So information age meaning exactly what as it relates to education?
Well, let me be very clear what I'm not saying. I'm not saying that we just need to give every kid an iPad and that they'll be fine, or even that every kid should be going to online school, because I don't think either of those is true. But what the technology does let you do is to try different approaches at low cost. And, in fact, I'm sure a lot of your listeners probably saw it, but there was an interview with Salman Khan, the founder of the Khan Academy in the Times, just the other day.
Yep, and he's been on this show. Uh-huh.
Right. He said, you know, one of the questions I asked him, which I think was really good, was they said, could you have done this without YouTube? And he said, no. He said, you know, just a few years earlier, hosting video online was so complicated and difficult and expensive, it just wouldn't have been worth the trouble. So, you know, it's in his model, it's not really that YouTube is doing the work. It's just making it possible to do things that you couldn't have done without the technological base. And their flipped classroom model, where students watch lectures, which is the sort of passive part of education, at home on video, and then go to the classroom where the teacher's there and do what traditionally would have been the homework and work problems when they have the teacher there to help them, is also, you know, it's made possible by the technology, but this is not a bunch of exciting technological bells and whistles. It's just the fact that the technology lets you reorganize things in a different way.
So, and listeners, I see some of you are starting to call in, so let me put out the number so everybody has it, 212-433-WNYC. I'm sure that this conversation is sparking reactions in many of you who are educators or college students or adults with student loan debt or anyone else, 212-433-9692. How scalable do you think the Khan Academy model is? And again, for people who don't know, the Khan Academy videos, Salman Khan, who came up with this idea, and they're very widely viewed now on YouTube. And he explains high school and college topics to viewers. And as you say, Glenn, sometimes it could be used, this model, in conjunction with going to class after you've watched the lecture on video, reversing the usual order of things. But is that scalable as something other than enrichment or a kind of video spark notes?
You know, I think it probably is, but all of this stuff, I mean, we're still very much at an experimental age. You know, my daughter did almost all of her high school online, and she did that because she went, you know, at the beginning of ninth grade to what's considered to be one of the better public high schools around here, and she came back and said, I've been keeping track of how we spend our time, and I'm only spending about 2.5 hours a day on actual work. The rest is all, you know, changing classes, dare lectures, pep rallies, and assorted other things that weren't actual education. And so we relented after some pressure and let her go do Kaplan's online college prep school. And that was really good for her. She got to take a lot of AP classes that wouldn't have been available in here, and she got to graduate at 16. And I think this was really beneficial. She got to hold down a job while she was doing that, because her schedule was freed up and opened up by doing it online. And I think she learned a lot from having that job. She worked at a TV production company here in town. And, you know, I think, frankly, warehousing kids in high schools has a lot of deleterious effects that are relieved if you can organize things more flexibly and get them out in the real world around high-value adults.
That's really interesting. So you're not just an academic with a theory. You're kind of practicing what you preach in your own family.
Well, yeah. In fact, my experience is sort of what led me to get interested in this stuff because, you know, I'm a law professor, and while I've written a couple of things about the changes that are going on in legal education, where the higher education bubble has sort of already popped in a lot of ways, I, you know, never thought I'd write about this stuff, but somehow I wound up doing it.
Yeah, Northwestern and other colleges, other law schools, I should say, are starting to offer two-year degrees to get a law degree instead of 3 years. That's kind of a bubble-bursting phenomenon, isn't it?
Oh, it really is. And, you know, you see this in plummeting numbers of applicants, in people now choosing schools over, you know, on price, not just where they are in the U.S. news rankings, in schools trying to buy students with increased financial aid and all kinds of things. I mean, in my world, what's going to happen in the rest of higher education in a few years is already happening.
Mitch in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Glenn Reynolds. Hi, Mitch.
Hi, Brian. Great show.
Thanks.
One of the things that you said, that since bank student loans are backed by the government, banks are going to still make those loans. I have a 17-year-old, just spoke to my guidance counselor, and the guidance counselor said, whatever you do, don't take a bank student loan because the interest rates are exorbitant. If you do your FAFSA and the government doesn't give you enough money to go to that school, don't go to the school. Don't take that bank student loan. The other thing is my brother-in-law works for a Fortune 50 company that moved all of its employees to North Carolina in exchange for getting a deal not to pay a cent in state income tax or state taxes for 10 years. Now, that's going to kill the local schools and the budget for local schools and universities and put the burden of educating its workers in North Carolina on the people who are also now paying their tax burden and give the company more reason to get those deferrals to get workers from India.
Wow.
So those are two aspects.
Yeah, those are two really interesting stories. Glenn?
Well, on the first thing, I have to say I love your guidance counselor because that is terrific advice. And you're hearing that more and more. I mean, people used to say that student loan debt was so-called good debt because it would help you make more money later. And what's changed in that is really just that tuition has grown at a rate far exceeding what people's incomes have grown at, so that they just don't match anymore. And people are catching on, and I'm glad to hear your guidance counselor saying it because it's great advice. My advice to people is I don't tell people don't borrow any money, but I would be extremely reluctant to borrow much. And you have to have a really close eye both on what you're likely to be able to earn and pay off your loans when you get out of college and what you're going to do if for some reason you wind up not graduating from college or changing majors or if the economy changes and the job situation looks worse when you get out. Because once you've got that student loan debt, it's just a ball and chain that you just really can't get out from under.
But, you know, there is some pushback on this argument, which, you know, is certainly growing as a topic of conversation around the country. The college debt may not be worth it. If the average debt is $30,000, which is, I think, approximately the number that they say, that's not that much over the course of a career, considering the usual lifetime advantage over not going to college, would you say?
No, I mean, the average debt is not so bad, but, you know, the average debt includes a lot of people who go to a state school and don't incur any debt and pull the number down.
Good point.
And those are the people you want to, those are the people you probably want to be. The formula for how much debt you can afford to carry, though, is that your starting salary should be about the same, you know, or no less than your student loan debt. $30,000 as a starting salary is out of college is not that bad. It's not great, but, you know, if you're carrying $30,000 in student loan debt and you get out of college, you better be able to find a job because those payments will come due. And the other thing is people get into deferments and stuff like this where they're not making payments right now, but the interest continues to pile up. It gets capitalized into the loan. And those people could get into serious trouble with frightening speed, especially if they have some of the high-interest loans. So I think the guidance counselor is absolutely right. Just don't borrow that kind of money to go to college. It's not likely to pay off. And even if you go and get a big paying job when you get out, if you owe a lot of student loan money, you're kind of stuck in that job because you have to make a lot of money to pay off those loans. And you might decide you'd rather do something else and make less, and you won't be able to.
Glenn Reynolds with us on WNYC, the blogger behind Instapundit, author now of The New School, How the Information Age Will Save American Education from Itself, and Vanessa in Reading. You're on WNYC. Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Good, thank you.
So there are actually a few points that you've touched on. One, my 11-year-old is working on math right now, and I needed a refresher because I was an English major and didn't have to take math in my university because I went to a university in New Zealand, and you only have to take your majors. You don't have to take the core. They expect you to know the core before you take classes. But I'm taking the Khan Academy math for myself to refresh myself so I can help my son on his homework. And then he's also doing some of the Khan Academy lessons, you know, if he doesn't quite get something. And he's also taking all the coding classes on the Code Academy and Khan Academy, the programming, because that's really what he's interested in. He's got Asperger's and he's really interested in computers. So his school doesn't offer it that at the sixth grade level, so he's doing it online.
You know, that is something I hear all the time, and in fact, I have a 9-year-old nephew who learned how to do Java animations on the Khan Academy a couple of months ago, and is now on there helping teach other kids how to do it, all at the age of 9. And I mean, I just think that's a terrific thing, especially when it's a resource that's online for free. And there are a lot of resources like that out there.
Vanessa, thank you for your call. That's a great story, but there are limits to this too. You know, if we're talking about how the information age is going to save conventional education from itself, we've seen the rise of MOOCs, the massive open online courses, hundreds or thousands of people taking some of these MIT courses online and other things without having to pay the tuition. But I think the most recent data indicates that a shockingly large number of those students never complete the course. So is that kind of a wake-up call to people who think that that's going to be transformational?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the truth is, you know, the lower the buy-in for something, the less likely people are to stick with it. And I think especially because MOOCs are new, an awful lot of people signed up just to sort of try them out, poked around for a while, decided they'd seen enough and didn't bother to finish because they weren't super interested in completing it to begin with. So it's hard to say. I also will say, you know, I'm definitely not saying that everybody's going to go to college online. I think there are a lot of things to be said for the classroom experience, for a good seminar and all of that, where you get interchange with other people. I think the big thing, though, is colleges are just going to have to bring down costs. Now, I have a few proposals that don't have much to do with technology. A lot of universities, for example, have outsourced much of their teaching to an army of low-paid, job-insecure adjuncts who usually don't even get benefits and teach for as little as $1,500, $2,000 a semester. But what I've noticed is nobody farms out the administrative work that way. So I propose we create a whole new category of adjunct administrators where, you know, the deans of student life and all these people who work on campuses are replaced by people who work for $2,000 a semester as a means of cutting costs.
You'll get a lot of votes on that if you ever get to put that to a referendum.
It'll do well in the Faculty Senate anyway.
And you make some predictions, or what you call quasi-predictions, in the book. One is customization. There'll be more smaller individual approaches to education, less one-size-fits-all. Another is gamification. Also integration, which is, I guess, more integration of education and the work world. Cheapification, you think that prices are going to come down because of the bubble, and a couple of others. But let me ask you about the customization, because that's what charter schools were supposed to be. Let a thousand flowers bloom, let people with experimental ways of doing things and organized around particular communities or communities of interest come in and do things in different ways. But I think we're starting to see the limits of the charter school movement, at least this phase of it, because national studies show that kids in charter schools don't, on average, do better than kids in regular public schools. And I think there's a trend toward a cookie-cutter approach to charter schools, you know, that they have a certain way that's pegged to standardized tests, just like regular education, that's becoming a charter school formula. And I wonder if you think that's happening and the charter schools are becoming less original.
Well, you certainly hear that. And I guess, you know, at some level that's to be expected as any phenomenon grows. I hope that charter schools do better, because one of the things I say in the book is that with people, especially in big cities, fleeing the public school systems for alternatives, and there was a great article in The Atlantic about how many hipster types in New York are homeschooling now because they're not happy with the public schools and the private schools are so expensive. That with people fleeing the system like that, public schools need something new that's going to keep people in the system and happy to pay taxes to support it. And if they can't do that through charter schools, I'm kind of not sure what they will do. I think, though, creativity is the way to go, and I think people really need to look at what's best for their kid. Which is going to be different for a lot of kids. If you've got a kid with Asperger's who's fascinated with computer science, online education may do them a lot of good. Some other kids may need, I mean, there are plenty of kids who benefit from a traditional classroom with the desks in a row in the Prussian style. That didn't come out of nowhere. I think, though, that people need to look at their kids and look at what's available and choose from a wider variety of choices instead of just packing them off to the local public school without a second thought, which is how we've traditionally done it for 100 years.
Let's get one more caller in here. Wasim in Parsippany. You're on WNYC. Good morning, Wasim.
Hey, good morning. Thanks. Great show, Brian. Very thought-provoking. And I think this is great reconsiderations bringing in the technology. But my question to Mr. Reynolds was regarding the origins of the current system we have. There was a big revolution brought on by John Dewey mid-19th century, and he had a very long span to influence. He's considered a great philosopher of progressive education. He did a lot of experiments also. So how do you contextualize our current educational system, the basic premises? I definitely am all for what I suppose you're promoting is taking the technological tool and platforms available. But I think the best idea would be to how to credential and make it more meaningful as accessible technology is for the professional or technical or career development at any point in life. You know, that I think would be a great revolution that you seem to be suggesting. But going back to John Dewey's, do you have any comments on that? You seem to have made a good point.
Thank you, Wasim. Glenn?
Well, that's a big question. John Dewey took the model that Horace Mann started with and basically made it more the way it was. I guess he refined it further in very much the same direction. And I'm not quite sure. I think the caller was suggesting that we substitute a certification routine. And I think that's not such a bad way to go. That's actually something that some other people have suggested. Dale Stevenson wrote a book called Hacking Your Education, and Anya Kamenetz wrote a book called DIYU, both of which suggested that there are so many different opportunities out there to learn that we should just focus on the certification part and let people sort of put together their own education. I will say the problem with that is that's probably a technique that works really well for the kinds of people who write books. It may not apply to the population as a whole, and as I say, there are people for whom traditional, desk in a row schooling is probably the best way to go. I don't think it's going to cease to exist.
Before you go, Glenn, probably a lot of listeners who are hearing you for the first time and live in, the progressive politically New York area are now going to go to your blog, and they're going to be a little shocked by what they see on Instapundit with a lot of conservative and libertarian posts. So you want to change up the context here just for a couple of minutes and give us your reaction to anything that most encouraged you or alarmed you in the State of the Union address?
I have to say it left me largely unmoved, as State of the Union addresses have done for pretty much my entire life. It's sort of the same kind of thing. One controversy, I was just on local radio talking about this, is about all the Obama executive orders. I think for the most part that's a bit overstated. I have a case I teach in administrative law sometimes about a case where Gerald Ford basically enacted a statute via executive order, and it was upheld by the courts. The president's been doing a lot of stuff by executive orders for a long time, and we probably shouldn't like that, and I don't, but I don't think there's as big a departure under Obama as a lot of the hype would suggest.
So interesting, coming from a law professor. As a libertarian, are you a big Second Amendment guy?
Oh, sure, yeah, and of course I live in Tennessee, where they're eagerly recruiting gun factories from other parts of the country that don't seem to want them. They just landed a big Beretta factory outside of Nashville yesterday.
So let me play you this 1:30-second clip from the State of the Union address and see if you can decode it for us, because I couldn't figure out what it meant. Listen.
Citizenship means standing up for the lives that gun violence steals from us each day. I've seen the courage of parents, students, pastors, police officers all over this country who say, we are not afraid. And I intend to keep trying, with or without Congress, to help stop more tragedies from visiting innocent Americans in our movie theaters and our shopping malls or schools like Sandy Hook.
So, Glenn, did you have any idea what he might be referring to there by saying that he intends to keep trying with or without Congress to do something about gun violence. Do you see any executive orders coming down the pike there after he couldn't get, the gun reform legislation through Congress?
I don't see much happening. I mean, the way State of the Union speeches are drafted, and this is one reason why they're typically so dull, is there are two groups. There's a whole bunch of constituencies, both inside and outside the government, that want their pet issue to get in there in some form. And then there are the political people who try to make sure that nothing gets in there that will commit the president to anything he doesn't really want to do. And in this case, I think, the compromise is he talks about it for 30 seconds. Or was it 40, did you say? Doesn't really say much of anything. And the constituency groups feel like he at least remembers they exist, and they move on.
Right.
I think they've concluded it's a lose-lose issue for them to get very involved with. So you just sort of hand-wave a little to your constituency groups so they feel like you at least care about them.
Yeah. All State of the Union addresses, as you say, have that laundry list of nods to different groups. What perked up my ears there was that he seemed to include it with that language in the short list of things or on the short list of things that he might actually take executive action without Congress to try to do so. Mystery unsolved. But we will have to leave it there with Glenn Harlan Reynolds, whose new book is The New School, How the Information Age Will Save American Education from Itself. Great conversation. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.